Well, this is my second attempt at moderation, or moderating, excuse me. And the session that we are going to enjoy this afternoon is Politics on Record. And we are in the Garden West Room. If you think you're not supposed to be in the Garden West Room, please leave now, all right? Because I don't want rudeness to encroach upon this wonderful panel. We are going to have two presentations, one by a passel of three and another passel of one. The first presentation will be entitled The Nixon Era White House Recordings. And the three members of this session are Carrie McStay. I got a little note from each one of these people. I'm reading what she says here. I received a BA in history from Sewanee, way down upon the Sewanee, and an MLIS from the University of Texas at Austin. I've worked at the Library of Congress, the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, and I currently serve as the supervisory archivist for the Nixon Presidential Library Tapes team. I particularly enjoy working with any type of AV collection, mostly because I wish I had more artistic talent. I'm a stickler about saying my name in blue ink, and have a basset hound. Oh, that's Cleo. Who remembers Cleo? There you go. And he just died. Jackie Cooper just died. Yeah, just died the other day, yeah. Yeah, there you go. I knew that. And she likes comics, so what better place than comics up here, right? Okay, person number two is Mark Scambatera. There you go. There you go. He's here. Glad to have you with us for what should be an interesting panel. See, I'm just reading his email to me. I would like to be introduced as follows. Or said, I would. It says, a would. All right, unless we do have wood to introduce. He's a graduate of Queens College of Graduate School of Library and Information Studies, San Francisco State University, and Rutgers College. A native of Edison, New Jersey, Mark currently resides in Tacoma Park. Take a ticket to Tacoma, if you remember. Maryland, a short bicycle ride from the National Archives and Records Administration Archives. Two, right? Is that a two? It's a number. Two, facility, where he works for the Richard M. Nixon Library and Museum Tapes Project. Let me know if there's anything else you may need from me. No, there isn't anything more. Last, never least, would be Tim Naftali. He's a historian, director of the Richard Nixon Library, and he works for the National Archives. I give you the three. Oh, I forgot. I'm Bill Shirk from Bowling Green State University, in case you have any name calling. Okay, thank you.
Sorry. Okay, well, thanks for coming. Today I'm going to share with you an access history of the White House tapes. I suspect I might not dazzle you with our archival processing, but I want to share with you our experience of processing this audio. I'm going to delve into the legal history and highlight tapes review and the challenges of the audio, summarize the finding aids we have created, and talk about our plans for the future. Any access history about these records cannot be untangled from their legal history. Franklin Roosevelt began the tradition of deeding his records back to the American people and preserving them in a library. When Nixon ordered the installation of a taping system in February 1971, he never thought the tapes would be anything but his personal property. But with the Watergate scandal, the records created by the administration became pivotal. Shortly after his resignation, Nixon made a deal with the General Services Administration. This agreement allowed Nixon to retain title on the materials and even had a clause that all tape recordings were to be destroyed after 10 years. Congress and President Ford acted immediately and signed the Presidential Recordings and Materials Preservation Act, PRIMPA, on December 19, 1974. PRIMPA seized the records in order to protect evidence related to Watergate and ordered the creation of regulations that for processing the records that took into account records related to Watergate. This slide is the actual quote from the law. And they also had to take into account these regulations, the privacy of the White House staff and the First Family. And these regulations were then drafted and litigated for years. In 1979, a negotiated agreement between Nixon and the National Archives settled details about abuses of governmental powers and designated as returnable documents and tapes reflecting Nixon's personal political associations. The agreement distinguished between Nixon's role as President of the United States and his role as head of the Republican Party. Material concerning the Republican Party and retail politics has since been considered personal. The negotiated agreement paved the way for the public access regulations, which were implemented in 1986 and are still in use today. Throughout this legal wrangling, staff worked towards releasing the entire tapes. They would have been heavily redacted for national security information. By 1990, they were ready for release. Nixon and then some of his top advisors sued and argued that privacy standards for paper documents could not apply to tapes. In 1993, a judge granted Nixon a preliminary injunction blocking release of the tapes until all of the personal material had been excised out of the entire tapes. And at this time, the National Archives made a very controversial decision to re-review the tapes. Concurrent with the Nixon lawsuits, the scholar Stanley Cutler and Public Citizen sued the National Archives to force the release of additional Watergate-related conversations and the complete conversations. In 1996, the tape settlement agreement between Cutler, the Archives, and the Nixon estate, as Nixon had died in 1994, allowed the release of tapes to move forward. Almost immediately, the National Archives released the abuse of governmental power segments, and shortly thereafter, the cabinet room conversations. The rest of the tapes were broken up into chronological releases covering spans of months. In 2004, Congress amended PRIMPA and the National Archives and the Nixon Foundation moved forward with the creation of the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. In July 2007, the Richard Nixon Library and Birthplace in Yorba Linda, the private museum established in 1990 and pictured here, came under the purview of the National Archives. At that time, the Nixon Foundation deeded back to the American people much of the personal material returned in the past. This has had an impact on tapes, which I will discuss in a bit. An additional storage facility was built in Yorba Linda, that's Tim, in the new facility, and in intervening years, the GIFT's textual and AV collections moved to California. Yorba Linda is now the main research arm with a reference copy of the tapes available in the reading room, and the original White House tapes and their processing operation are still in College Park. If you find some time for some tourism, I'd like to mention on March 31st, 2011, the library in Yorba Linda opened a new Watergate exhibit, and the exhibit includes significant tapes content. Okay, tapes review is now where the law and the deed of gift meet archival description. Reviewers listen to every second of tape, create the tape subject log finding aids, and generate the appropriate documentation for editing and justifying release or closure. Reviewers restrict portions of conversation that contain national security or violate the privacy of a living person, and then they return to the Nixon estate those conversations determined to be personal. There are some lesser withdrawal categories related to statutes, proprietary information, and investigative information. An example from one of these would be something like the formula for Coca-Cola being said in the Oval Office. That would have been restricted for proprietary information. The basic challenge for review include execution of this complicated legal framework and the presence of unmarked national security information. I dream of a day when Henry Kissinger would say, "Now I'm going to speak at the top secret level, Mr. President." It's never gonna happen. Significant difficulties come from the audibility and intelligibility of the audio. The taping system was designed for simplicity and comprehensiveness in capturing audio. The Secret Service installed two Sony 800B recorders at designated locations. Microphones were hidden in locations and then directly wired to the recorders. For example, the microphone wires passed through holes cut in the floor and led to a room below the Oval Office where the recording machines were kept. The recording speed was 15/16 IPS on half millimeter tape, and each reel could hold 6.5 hours. The nature of recorded human conversation among close personal associates make conversations free-flowing and difficult for us flies on the wall to interpret. The unshielded microphone wires picked up additional power line hum and other interference, especially in the executive office building. Other noises greatly affect conversation, including small things as signing documents or clinking coffee cups. Following on that, microphone placement was an issue. The Oval Office was well bugged, while the EOB was only bugged in the desk, so conversations occurring away from the desk are very hard to hear. So now I'm going to walk you through a few examples demonstrating the process of review and difficulties in listening. My first example demonstrates how clear a tape can be, but how the audio can become difficult. This is a conversation between the president and the new ambassador to India, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. This is a photo from the meeting, and just remember there are microphones in the desk.
You tell Scowcroft that I want a personal letter to go to her, that it should be not cold, but they can point out, I want them to point out to you, put in some of the stuff of our long, close personal relationship, that it's interesting to note from political standpoint, you are a Democrat, that therefore this is an indication of our bipartisan approach to the problems in the wider relationships. We hope to, you're not there, but we have a discussion.
Does anyone want to venture a guess as to what happened here on the tape to obscure the conversation?
Vacuum?
You're getting there, huh? You could be a tapes reviewer. Many times the tapes capture the arrival of Marine One on the White House lawn. I did this with a friend and she was like, a lawnmower? But, okay, my next example covers privacy. As Moynihan departs the room, the Secretary of the Interior, Roger C.B. Morton, enters. Morton tells the president that he will be taking 5 weeks to go to Palo Alto for cancer treatment. Morton died in 1979, so we can release this private conversation, but there is another layer to this conversation. As the president talks with Morton, he makes some remarks, which are my next clip.
Just how one, I never forget speaking at the
while what the president said leads a reviewer to believe Vandenberg is deceased, the point I want to make is that reviewers must pay attention to every second, process the content, and work to guarantee privacy. Please remember I needed to find examples of privacy-type information for a deceased individual that I can share with you. If one of these individuals was living, a reviewer would need to consider a privacy withdrawal. Now on to national security. Reviewers use declassified documents and guidance from federal agencies to precisely identify declassified material and restrict classified material. These will be clips from a conversation with the head of state, the King of Jordan. As a comment, that sconce had a microphone in it. I'm going to play a brief clip of Henry Kissinger speaking about schedules. His accent is a minor audio challenge, especially for beginning reviewers. Now here's the King of Jordan talking to the president. Just to emphasize the fact that review is done without transcripts, I'm going to play this short clip without a transcript.
Well, sir,
He is speaking English, by the way. The difficulties of reviewing this conversation were alleviated when reviewers found a memo of conversation for this meeting with attachments. Here you will see that the memo indicates the King read from an aide memoir. Here is a paragraph from the tab A mentioned in the last slide, and I'm going to play the clip again. So because we identified these declassified documents present in the library's own collections, it allowed us to release the audio. Now I would like to turn briefly to personal returnables and the deed of gift. This conversation with Patricia Hitt demonstrates PRIMPA-related materials and personal returnables. Hitt has come to the Oval Office for a farewell meeting with the president, as she was not reappointed during the second term. Action, a volunteer initiative she had worked on, was terminated by the president. Parts of the conversation where Hitt advises the president in her capacity as an appointee were understood as governed by PRIMPA. Here's a clip.
If action as an agency is abolished, this is the end. I'm not being over dramatic. I'm not kidding. This is the end of volunteerism in this administration. It not only will be interpreted that way, but to all intents and purposes, it'll be the case.
In this conversation, parts of the conversation where the President Hitt and John Ehrlichman discussed California politics were identified as pertaining to the President's role as head of the Republican Party and were therefore returnable. The 2007 Deed of Gift allows archivists to open previously identified returnable segments, except those reflecting the medical history and non-Watergate-related finances of the President and the private non-public activities of the First Family. So here's a clip with the political discussion that we have now opened under the Deed of Gift.
Ronald Reagan wants only one thing. He's been running for the President of the United States since 1960.
But to translate that, he's got to control the Republican Party in the state of California.
While it's fantastic we can release more, the experience of review has been complicated in that a reviewer is constantly toggling mentally between the deed of gift world and the PRIMPA world. From a finding aid perspective, the White House tapes have never been processed with an intent to transcribe. I have an example about the perils of transcription. I believe most of this peril happens because of transcribing secretly recorded human conversation as compared to, say, intentionally recorded interviews. This is also a good example of how it can be difficult to unpack a conversation. In this segment, the President and Haldeman are discussing the number two man at the FBI, Mark Felt. Earlier in the conversation, Haldeman tells Nixon that he has a source who has informed him that Felt is leaking. The two do not explicitly refer to Felt as a Watergate leak or Bob Woodward's deep throat. They only discuss that he is leaking. The two weigh their options about whether they should inform the head of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, about Felt's leaking. However, they fear that will compromise their source in the FBI. The clip I will play is a discussion between Nixon and Haldeman about what to do with Felt. The transcript I am using was created by scholars. This conversation is in the EOB, and the president had a clock on his desk that the microphones also in the desk picked up.
What were you doing, Tony? I asked him. He said he can't possibly get his wife to him. He hasn't committed any. I would like to go out and say, the White House tried to squelch him and all the rest. I know I shouldn't do that. That's fine.
Key because it would advance all my animation. Now I'm going to play it, the last two lines for you again. And I'm going to play it now with some transcript revisions.
How I do it?
two separate scholars had transcribed bastard instead of ambassador. Also, I could poll everyone in this room, and there would still be people who might feel they heard bastard. Transcripts would be prohibitive to us releasing anything. The fundamental finding aid for the White House tapes has always been the tape subject log. They include conversation numbers, date, time, and location, action statements indicating the presence of participants, and then logs include our detailed hierarchical outlines of topics discussed. They indicate when material is withdrawn and for which category. And recent logging is offset indicating review done under the deed of gift. In the past, after review had been completed, technician level staff would line by line hand index tape subject logs for geographical names, personal names, and acronyms. Staff entered a tape number into the index when a topic was mentioned. This forced compound searching, as researchers still needed to identify the conversation number. The system also obscured topics. There was no access to anything like the silent majority, the killing of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Olympics, and the arrival of the panda bears at the National Zoo. Technology has offered us a chance to improve access. In 2007, the Nixon Library used Adobe Acrobat Pro to create an Adobe catalog of the tape's finding aids. All tape subject logs, transcripts from the Watergate Special Prosecution Force, scope and content notes, and database reports, it's over 1,000 finding aids, were turned into PDFs. Only some transcripts were scanned and subject to optical character recognition. The logs were turned into PDFs from their original word processing formats. This simple function in an off-the-shelf software has allowed for automated indexing of all the tape's finding aids. Because of the electronic foundation of the logs, the tape's index is quite crisp and effective. Metadata was added to document properties to improve usability of the index, especially in reviewing results. There are some significant benefits, including automated full-text indexing, navigation directly to the hit, highlighting of the hit, relevance ranking, which usually indicates a topic is discussed significantly. Our drawbacks are an inability to print results, complications in web enabling, the index is available as a mailed CD-ROM or as a downloadable zip, and imperfect optical character recognition. In recent years, we have strived to make the hard part of the tapes be the listening, not the location of topics of interest. This has been greatly alleviated at the finding aid level, but remains difficult at the physical and listening level, with researchers using cassettes or multiple large-scale CD and MP3 files. The library has put conversations from the final chronological release online. Two third-party entities, the Miller Center at the University of Virginia and NixonTapes.org, have digitized tapes, but the files are large, up to 2 hours in duration. So audio is available online, but requires patience to navigate. Finding aids are not annotated with time codes. Tapes go through first review, second review, editing, quality control, and would then require another listen of the reference audio to time code it. Keep in mind that staff were hand indexing until 2007. So our future, we intend to complete the final chronological release, which is tapes from April of 73 to July of 73. And we have maintained some antiquated processes in order to get the difficult work of review done. Next, we want to move forward with the tapes as a digital collection. We face a multitude of challenges, including engaging in smart planning, and that we will correctly manage and preserve this digital collection we anticipate creating. We need to figure it out bureaucratically. Many of the policy documents within the agency have a visual collection slant, and we need to understand how our work would fit with the archival research catalog developed at the National Archives. We need to figure it out on an internal level. What is the role of the tapes reviewer and the technical staff as review merges with technical editing? What kind of storage system do we design for classified unedited versions of the tapes and the unclassified edited version? And workload is a challenge. We need to refer classified information to agencies and other collections might need processing. Our digital planning is truly in a nascent stage. We're hoping to have something like this, which would be time-stamped finding aids, unified with a player and a search interface. This is out of the National Library of Australia. So that's about it. Thank you for coming. Oh, and I have business cards and free to answer any questions.
So, good afternoon. Sound all right? Good. Having listened to all the conversations recorded on May 13, 1971, I can honestly say that I'm astounded by the number of public policy issues that are in 9 hours of tapes. While listening to the Nixon tapes, I learned about the Gautreaux Chicago Housing Authority case. I learned about federal fund dollars being sent to states for use in private education, vouchers in effect, and that men who designed women's clothes in the 70s really hated women. Seriously, when I started this project, I had three main goals in mind. I wanted to work with the Nixon tapes outside a brick-and-mortar library. I wanted to demonstrate some of the ways that recorded conversations can be utilized with other presidential records. And I wanted to exploit the tapes to show historical events correctly. This presentation starts with a general overview of conversations recorded on the 13th, and then offers brief historical narratives punctuated by recorded conversations. On the left-hand side of this slide is actually a copy of the President's Daily Diary, compiled for May 13th. The document is a record of presidential activities throughout the day, starting with breakfast at 8:10 in the morning. Also recorded in the Daily Diary are the names with people with whom the President met. For example, at 8:56 a.m., the President met with Dwight Chapin. In the midst of this meeting, Henry Kissinger entered the Oval Office at 8:57. Kissinger remained in the Oval Office as Chapin left, and then Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman joined them at 9:28, with the meeting already in progress. During this meeting, the President also received a telephone call from Secretary of State William Rogers, and that's indicated very timely in an R next to the time when the telephone conversation occurred, 9:35. So looking at this slide, I annotated the Daily Diary to show that conversations correspond to presidential activities. The blue-colored annotations show which activities captured on the Oval Office, Cabinet Room, and White House telephone, and the arrows point to those. For example, the President's meeting at 12:22 p.m. with the Citizens Committee for Government Reorganization was the second conversation captured on Cabinet Room Tape 57, and thus it's written shorthand as Cabinet Room 57-2 or CAB 57-2. Similarly, the President's telephone call to his daughter at 8:40 a.m. was the 40th conversation captured on White House Telephone Tape 3, thus WHT 3-40. Keep in mind, though, that the Daily Diary is not entirely accurate. The black-colored annotations refer to conversations captured on tape for which there's no record of a presidential activity. For example, Oval 498-9 contains a recording of the President dictating a letter to Walter Trohan on a dictabelt machine. Ironically, it's a recording of a recording. And Oval 498-10 captured the President's meeting with Stephen Bull, but neither of these are listed on the Daily Diary itself. By the same token, not every activity was captured on tape. The red-colored annotations highlight presidential activities that occurred in areas of the White House not covered by the tapes. In the evening, the President placed telephone calls and then had dinner with his daughter, but there's no recording of these conversations. So what happened on the 13th, or 40 years ago today? On May 13th, a total of 30 conversations occurred and were recorded in the Oval Office, primarily on tapes 3 and 498. The conversations involved mundane subjects like the President's schedule with the barber later that day, as well as complex public policy issues such as U.S. military commitments to Vietnam and Europe, government reorganization, and funding for cancer research. The personal impressions of the President are also readily heard, including his opinions on homosexuality, marijuana, television, and especially people. Listening to a day in the life of the President, you really get a sense of kind of a world swirling around a very real human being. So, in addition to the Daily Diary, it's very helpful if users utilize briefing papers, memorandum of conversation, and presidential records, other presidential records, as well as published monographs and memoirs to help guide them through conversations. Most conversations captured on the Nixon tapes are well documented, either beforehand or in post facto notes and such. This slide contains a copy of the first page of a three-page briefing memo written by John Ehrlichman for the President's use in preparing for a meeting with Chicago Mayor Richard Daley on the 13th. The meeting, initially recommended by New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller, was set up as a means to throw Daley a lifeline to a Republican White House. In return, Ehrlichman wrote the President, "Daley should be encouraged to serve as a liaison for the administration to key Chicago Democrat congressmen, particularly Dan Rostenkowski, who sat on the House Ways and Means Committee." Improvising the script, Nixon told Daley, the three-page briefing paper also includes a plan, it's a press plan basically, which called for a photograph of Daley and the President. So knowing that fact, you could actually talk to the Nixon archivist and get them to help you locate that photograph. Like the president, when I want to prepare for an important meeting, I read about my subject. I gather copies of the tape subject logs, briefing papers, memorandum for the Nixon archive, and I read published works such as Haldeman's Diary and Henry Kissinger's memoir, White House Years, so that I can better follow the dialogue. It's actually a lot easier to listen when you know what you're about to hear, but sometimes it's not all that clear what you're hearing. This slide shows an annotated copy of page 8 from tape subject log Oval 498. This subject log produced by the Nixon Library is a finding aid in the form of a chronological and hierarchical listing of main and subheadings discussed in conversation Oval 498-2. This conversation occurred during a meeting between the President, Kissinger, and Haldeman on the morning of the 13th. Looking at the highlighted portion of this log, you may note that the President issued instructions for Henry to bomb North Vietnam. But did Henry execute the order? And then a debate ensues.
No, after the 20th, let's get the announcement under the belt. Let's not get that.
See, your problem, see, too, with any kind of a summit announcement, once it's gone, it's going to tie our hands. You see, you've got to do anything you've got to do. We want to be in a position to bang them. But we got to bang them somehow, Henry. We cannot have them tear down our prisoner offer, you know, just kick us around in Paris. We've got to do something.
I agree completely, and I think but I just think, Mr. President, to be having gotten this close, we can wait 5 days.
Why does Henry want to wait? In the previous tape segment, Kissinger argued that the president should not bomb until after an announcement is made that the Soviet Union has agreed to restart strategic arms limitation talks with the U.S. Kissinger's reason is plainly stated, and our question is ostensibly answered. But there's a subtext. The president was clearly upset about North Vietnam's negotiating position with regard to U.S. prisoners of war. In his opinion, they had shown bad faith. And then the next segment, it's borne out.
Just have no illusions. We're not going to go to hear from the North Vietnamese. We don't think, having that in mind, we play out the string.
There's something funny going on, though. Le Duan, who was 4 weeks in Moscow, now he's in Peking.
Oh.
There's something. Something is
getting ready for the defensive.
No.
The subtext here revolves around the resumption of peace talks with North Vietnam and the U.S. In White House Years, Kissinger recalled that on April 24th, CIA Deputy Director Vernon Walters delivered a message to North Vietnam offering to restart peace negotiations in Paris on May 16th. With only 3 days remaining until the deadline and no answer from Hanoi, Kissinger remained hopeful that Le Duan's diplomatic mission to Moscow and Peking would result in North Vietnam resuming peace negotiations. Kissinger argued against bombing Hanoi in part because he wanted to give North Vietnam more time to reply, and he was rewarded for his patience. With characteristic generosity of spirit, he wrote in White House Years, Hanoi waited until May 14th to reply. Haldeman noted in his diaries on May 13th, however, that Kissinger was ecstatic because he heard back from the North Vietnamese, so it was a little difference in dates there. A similar question can be asked with regard to a conversation that took place late in the afternoon on the 13th between the President, Haldeman, and Ehrlichman, during which the President mentioned the Internal Revenue Service and the appointment of a new commissioner.
I want to be sure that, what's his name, Walters?
Yes.
I want to be sure he is a ruthless son of a bitch, that he'll do what he's told, that every income tax return I want to see, I see, that he'll go after our enemies and not go after our friends. Not as simple as that. If he isn't, he doesn't get the job.
So based on this conversation, did the president order Haldeman and Ehrlichman to make certain that Walters would use the IRS bureaucracy to investigate the income tax returns of political enemies? The conversation itself is ambiguous because the president is referring to possible future actions, not an order already executed. The president later said in the same conversation, I will do nothing that isn't in the law. So again, we turn to other documentary evidence. Ehrlichman and Haldeman's notes from this day refer to Walters. What about John Walters? Ruthless, loyal, show us returns, do as he's told, go after our enemies? Yet neither man apparently wrote an action memorandum in response to the president's statements regarding Walters. Yet in 1974, Walters testified before the Senate Select Presidential Campaign Activities, he was told his nomination would not clear Ehrlichman's desk unless he retained Roger Barth, a putative White House spy, in his current position as special assistant to the commissioner. Having given his assurance that he would keep Barth on for at least 90 days, Walters' nomination was submitted to Congress June 21st, 1971. Haldeman's notes of June 23rd show that he intended to move forward with the enemy's list project. Now have our man in IRS, pull Clark Clifford and top supporters of Doves, full field audit. Let's see what we can make of it. Coulson, make a list of the ones we want. The following day, George Beall, assistant to White House counsel Charles Coulson, compiled a list of 20 enemies, which Coulson whittled down to 11 before submitting to John Dean in response to Dean's August 16, 1971 memorandum entitled Dealing with Our Political Enemies. While the enemies list grew rapidly during 1971 and 72, Walters proved unwilling to act upon repeated requests to investigate tax returns for political purposes. This is evident from a number of sources, including undated briefing paper prepared by Dean for Haldeman's meeting with Walters' boss, Treasury Secretary George Shultz, in which he urged that Walters be more responsive to White House requests for action. Ultimately, George Shultz told Walters to disregard an order given by the president through Dean on September 11, 1972, to conduct IRS audits on the individuals cited on the enemies list. So when compiled together, the IRS conversation, the notes, the memoranda, the briefing paper support the conclusion that the president encouraged his subordinates to gather confidential tax information for unlawful purposes. His actions as such were cited in the House Judiciary Committee's impeachment report under Article 2, Paragraph 4. Well, the president discussed automobile safety several times on the 13th. One issue raised was specifically how to delay regulations on the installation of passive restraint systems in cars manufactured after August 15, 1973. On May 13th, during a two-hour meeting between Ehrlichman, Haldeman, and the president, Ehrlichman said that he had Transportation Secretary Volpe's handwritten commitment to sink the airbag on June 14th. The president then ordered Ehrlichman to get Coulson to exploit this fact with special interests. Ehrlichman, who was not sensing what the president's meaning was told,
"I'm talking about very necessary to exploit that. I'm on with those.
Oh, I see. All right. I follow. All right. I'm a little psyched.
The president did this. We're going to take heat from that."
The president then suggested that he solicit funds from General Motors.
"But also, somebody ought to move on GM. I wouldn't bother with Chrysler.
Sorry about that. At 2:30 p.m., the president met with James Roche, chairman of the board of General Motors, who, as it turned out, was already scheduled for a meeting of the Citizens Committee for Government Reorganization in the cabinet room that same day. During the meeting, the president laid out his position on automobile safety.
"On the safety side, I can only say that I think most of those people are crazy. I mean, this seatbelt thing with the fire going off or the lights flashing and all that sort of thing. Ridiculous. It's all ridiculous, and it's going to be stopped."
And he assured Roche,
"It's sure going to happen if we do our best. And but what we have to do, John, is to get a hold of those nuts over there in that department. The way to do it, the way to handle it politically is very simple. Delay.
Well,
this delay.
The procedurally,
10 years.
On May 17th, Ehrlichman wrote a confidential memorandum to Coulson asking him to follow up on the Roche meeting. Transportation Secretary Volpe did offer a revised ruling on passive restraints, calling on automakers to install systems on cars manufactured after 1976. The president actually approved Volpe's ruling on September 22, 1971, but regulations mandating passive restraint systems would be delayed through court action and further safety testing until Congress passed legislation in 1991, mandating the installation of passenger side airbags for cars manufactured after 1998. So, last example. The tapes often tell us exactly how policy decisions are made. On May 11, 1971, Senator Michael Mansfield from Montana offered up an amendment to a draft bill for renewal of the Selective Service Act of 1967. The Mansfield Amendment, if passed, would cut funding by year's end for approximately 150,000 U.S. troops stationed in Europe. Senator Mansfield had long sought to reduce U.S. troop levels in Europe, and with the U.S. running its first balance of payments deficit of the 20th century, Mansfield argued that recalling troops home from Europe would also repatriate U.S. dollars otherwise spent by soldiers abroad. During a morning meeting in the Oval Office with Kissinger and Haldeman, the president talked briefly by telephone with Secretary of State Rogers about arrangements for a meeting on the subject of the amendment.
"Well, 4:30 today, I'm just going to, if we could get every farmer, you know, Secretary of State and so forth and so on, President, to come up this."
After completing the call to Rogers, the president and Kissinger dismissed the idea of compromising with the Senate.
"The line has got to be gotten at where there's no compromise.
We also must be careful not to accept even a compromise that says we should negotiate with the Europeans to reduce our troops.
Yeah,
because
that's up to us. We cannot have the Senate tell us what to do."
On the 13th, the president met with a number of current and former cabinet officials, joint chiefs of staff, and NATO commanders, including Dean Acheson, Dean Rusk, and George Ball. The president opened the meeting and laid out his argument against Mansfield's amendment.
Yes. We move on the NATO, and we make this move. We make it because we think the threat is nice. We make it because we think the Europeans ought to be more. We do it unilaterally, regardless of what the Europeans do, or with an amendment which puts them into doing it, so forth and so on. The effect on the balance of Europe would be quite significant. I think the effect on the Russians and the Soviet would be very detrimental. But the effect on the Germans would be catastrophic.
President Nixon suggested that the United States and its European allies were experiencing a breakthrough point in history, and he cited SALT negotiations as one area in which a breakthrough with the Soviet Union was possible. But the U.S. negotiating position was untenable if you had to bargain both with Congress and the Soviet Union. The conversation then turned to congressional action as Cyrus Vance asked the president if there was any room for compromise, given the fact that Senator Mansfield may have the votes he needed to pass this bill. The president, for his part, argued it for a hard line with Congress.
I believe that right now the best part is just to plow straight ahead, strong ahead, and frankly, what these fellows have to do, let's face it. They got to stand up and be statesmen on this.
There followed a head count. Sorry about that, there followed a head count of senators, 38 for, 38 against, 23 undecided, provided by Clark McGregor, White House Legislative Counsel to the president. Using McGregor's list, the participants committed themselves to buttonhole those senators whose vote they thought they could influence. After the assembled group divided up the senators, Dean Acheson proposed that the president issue a public statement in support of maintaining current U.S. troop levels to NATO. Similar statements, Acheson recommended, should be signed by living ex-presidents of the United States, living ex-secretaries of state, undersecretaries of state, and so on. The president endorsed Acheson's statement, praising its bipartisan tone, though he expressed an interest in revising the draft. As you listen to the Acheson read his draft statement, you may notice that the revisions are reflected in the public statement issued by the president on the 15th of the month.
It would be an error of historic dimensions for any of the North Atlantic Treaty allies to reduce at this point in history the forces they have on arms in Europe for the common defense. As the most important member, most powerful member of the alliance, the United States bears the responsibility for leadership. Let us persevere to carry forward the bipartisan policy of five successive presidents, confident that our united strength will promote the enduring peace we seek. He signs, which is the next president of the United States, and then a statement saying, we heartily support the statement of the presidents, Harriet Truman, and so on.
That same day, the White House released a list of names of individuals who supported the president's statement, followed by press statements of support signed by President Lyndon Johnson and Truman. As you may be able to see from this slide, on May 19th, 81 senators voted against the Mansfield Amendment. It's down here. And that's a significant margin in support of the president. So, in conclusion, I thoroughly enjoyed this project. I conducted most of the research at home in my PJs. I downloaded the tape subject logs, the audio files, and many of the documents to my home computer from publicly accessible internet websites, and I was able to listen to, edit, and cut audio tracks using free editing software. When I had a question, I called the knowledgeable staff at Nixon West in Yorba Linda. Sure enough, the reference archivist helped me find Haldeman's notes, Daley's briefing paper, and Roche's picture, among other supporting documents. But honestly, though, I found working with the tapes is not uncomplicated. The tapes are candid and emotional at times, and conversations often feature ambiguous, even contradictory evidence. For the listener, it's pretty difficult to interpret a one-off comment as a firmly held belief or an opening statement in a debate as a presidential directive. But if you properly contextualize the president's conversation, there's actually no limit to the ways in which you can use the content to teach others. So my last is a list of electronic resources that will help you do research at home in your PJs. And thanks. Sky's the limit, man. Yeah.
All right. Escape. Right. If we can just get back to, when is it? Let me just go back to the original screen, right? Get rid of that. And go back to my computer, right? Mm-hmm. And then go to Tim. It's me. Open. All right. Okay. My colleagues have brilliantly shown you how to use the tapes and how we make them accessible to you. What I'd like to do briefly today is talk to you about a subject that one would assume we already know about, which is the Watergate on the tapes. Because after all, Watergate is what made the tapes possible for the public. As Carrie mentioned, before Watergate, the very existence of presidential recordings, not simply of Richard Nixon, but of the five presidents who taped before him, was unknown to the public. The backstory to Watergate and the tapes, of course, is the testimony of John Dean in 1973 before the Senate Watergate Committee. In June of 1973, John Dean would be the first White House insider to allege that Richard Nixon was involved in a cover-up that would have influenced the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's investigation of the break-in on June 17, 1972 at the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington, D.C. at the Watergate. 1 month after John Dean gave his testimony, and of course the White House was vehement in saying that John Dean was lying, 1 month later, prosecutors, the press, the Senate, the courts, and the public were handed the most unbelievable opportunity to determine whether John Dean or Richard Nixon was lying. Alexander Butterfield was questioned by the Watergate committee staff. He was asked, was there a taping system? And to everyone's surprise, he said yes. I have to tell you that in preparing our Watergate exhibit, which Carrie so kindly mentioned for the library, we interviewed a staff member of the Senate Watergate Committee to find out why they asked that question. And it turned out that, in fact, the question was suggested to them by someone who had worked in the Johnson administration and was well aware that Johnson had a taping system. And that person said, you know, Johnson had a taping system, and perhaps President Nixon did too. So they asked the question of Alexander Butterfield, and in July of 1973, Butterfield tells the staff, and then he tells the entire country there is a taping system. From that moment on, the tapes would be determinative, many people felt, of the extent to which the cover-up would affect the Nixon presidency. What's key to understand, and one of the reasons why people do not understand exactly what we have on the tapes about Watergate, is that the entire investigation, or the entire use of the tapes, was slanted from the start because it was used to determine John Dean's veracity. So the Senate, the Watergate special prosecutor, in determining and shaping the subpoena for the very first collection of tapes, only looked for tapes that involved John Dean and the president. So the very famous first nine tapes that were requested and ultimately were turned over, actually it turned out that one did not exist. It wasn't because it was deleted. It was the taping system had run out that night. And the other one has the famous 8.5-minute gap. But when those tapes were turned over, they had to do with Nixon's relationship with Dean. But that is not core. That is not central to understanding the president's role in the cover-up. There would be a second special prosecutor. This is after Archibald Cox was fired by the Solicitor General Robert Bork on the order of President Nixon in the fall of 1973. A second Watergate special prosecutor would ask for 64 tapes. And that was a wild goose chase. They looked at the kinds of logs, the daily diary that Mark showed you, and tried to figure out what meetings in the summer of 1972 might have involved Watergate. And they thought maybe this meeting on June 23rd, 1972 might be a good meeting. At that point, the John Dean-Richard Nixon struggle was not the central investigative point for determining which tapes to look for. It was basically a blind effort to figure out when might the president, if he participated in a cover-up, have said something. It's those 64 tapes that the president would oppose the release of that would lead to the U.S. v. Nixon Supreme Court case that would ultimately result in the Supreme Court saying that there is a limit to executive privilege, that when it's a matter of investigating or providing discovery for a criminal investigation, the president, there's a limit to the president's ability to deny information to a court. And that led to the president's decision in August of 1974 to turn over a bunch of tapes which would include something known as the smoking gun tape. Now, the public didn't hear the smoking gun tape. In fact, it's a misnomer. The public would only get a transcript. The smoking gun tape is a transcript that was made public by the administration on August 5th, 1974. That would be a determinative moment in the story because when people looked at the transcript, it directly contravened a presidential statement on May 22nd, 1973, when the president said, "I did not order the CIA to prevent the FBI from investigating Watergate." In fact, as this transcript showed, the president had done just that. The public would not hear this tape until 1980. In the trial in 1974-75, the Watergate conspiracy trial or cover-up trial, the jurors heard the tape, but the power of the tape, the public never heard. In fact, I would say for most people, they talk about the smoking gun tape and they've never actually heard it. Well, let me play a small portion to you where the president is basically agreeing to use the CIA to stop the FBI investigation, and he's telling Haldeman, his chief of staff, exactly what to tell the number two at the CIA, a guy named Vernon Walters, about why we want the CIA to prevent, what we want Walters to tell the FBI as a rationale for the CIA's prevention of this particular investigation. Baby comes up, I'm going to give you a full screen if it wants to be nice to me. If it doesn't want to be nice to me, to me, I will simply just imitate because I've heard this enough. You know, yes, that would be off the record. All right. Now.
What's his name? Walters. And the proposal would be that Erwin and I call him in. All right, fine. And say, how do you call him in? Well, we prepared to help him on a hell of a lot of things. That's what Erwin is. This is Hunt. That'll uncover a lot of legal.
Sorry about that. That tape, as I said, was not played. Well, it would have been played more correctly. But that tape wasn't played to the public. The transcript, and when members of the Judiciary Committee that had voted for the president read that transcript, they realized that indeed the president participated in obstruction of justice, and they all announced that they would vote, to impeach. But that's not the full story. And the tapes provide a much deeper understanding of the role of President Nixon, not simply in the cover-up that ensued after the break-in in 1972, but the abuses of power that, as Mark mentioned, were also mentioned by the House Judiciary Committee in the three articles of impeachment, particularly Article 2, that it passed by a bipartisan majority in July of 1974. But why don't you know these tapes? Well, because of the convoluted and complicated way in which they came out. As Kerry mentioned, there was a rearguard action by certain interests to make it difficult for the Watergate-related tapes to come out. In 1980, as I said, the tapes that were played in the trial, the 12 and a half hours that were played in the Watergate cover-up trial, were released to the public. In 1993, the National Archives, our predecessors in the Nixon Project, released the so-called abuse of government power tapes from May and June of 1972. After that release, the Nixon Foundation and the president himself sought to prevent further releases. And only in 1996, with a settlement involving scholar Stanley Cutler, a public citizen, the Nixon Foundation, and the National Archives, did they come up with the system that Kerry mentioned as the blueprint for releasing the remainder of the tapes, including the remainder of the abuse of government power tapes. Those were released in November of 1996. There are 201 hours that were released then of abuse of government power tapes. 10% of them were transcribed by Dr. Cutler. But besides Dr. Cutler's book, these tapes, I can tell you, have not really shaped Watergate literature. For the most part, people rely on Dr. Cutler's transcripts, which are reasonably good, but he couldn't hear a lot. And what he couldn't hear, he didn't transcribe, and he had to make very severe decisions about what he would include. But there's 201 hours of tape. My experience in transcribing tapes at the Miller Center, where I was before I ran the Presidential Recordings Program there, was that it took us about 1,200 pages to transcribe 70 hours. Dr. Cutler's book is about 600 pages for 200 hours. I would estimate that really it would take about 3,600 pages to transcribe all of the abuse of government power tapes. And our experience now in the tapes reference business is that people are a little bit nervous about going to the original tapes. They would prefer a transcript. However, the inherent flaws, believe me, having done transcripts, I understand it's an art, not a science. So the upshot of it is that there are phenomenally interesting and important segments on the tapes that relate to the extent to which we had abuse of governmental power in the Nixon administration and the extent to which the president himself is involved in a cover-up that the general public and, in fact, many scholars do not know. I'm going to play two for you right now. One of them is a phenomenal conversation, and I say phenomenal because my background is in the history of intelligence services before I joined the government. In the Cold War, presidents sought something called deniability, plausible deniability. Our president is commander-in-chief of the army. He is head of state. He's head of government. When he goes abroad, he's the diplomat-in-chief. It is very important for our president to be able to say plausibly that we are not engaged in a covert action in another country. Before the legislative changes of the 1980s, there was an Aesopian language that one can see through declassified records, that presidents used to authorize covert action. Deniability was essential. What you're about to hear is not a foreign covert action, but a discussion of a domestic covert action that occurred just down the street from here in Beverly Hills. This is the famous Fielding break-in, when the plumbers broke into the psychiatric office of the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist in order to find damaging information on him. This conversation occurs 5 days later in September of 1971, and listen to how the president is informed that a domestic covert action has occurred. He's also informed about some other things that the plumbers are doing. This tape was only made public at the end of the 1990s, and frankly has not really gotten into the bloodstream of students of the Nixon administration. And I apologize that it will, of course, be very slow, and I will again have to promise you a little bit of an interpretive dance, or I could do Ehrlichman, I can do the president reasonably well, although that's probably getting it. There we go. And I'll do full screen.
So we'll review all this stuff. We try to do. We had one little operation that aborted out in Los Angeles, which I think it's better if you don't know about. But we've got some dirty tricks underway that may pay off. We planted a bunch of stuff with colonists.
get into service, in fact, about this group, about the Ellsberg lawyer, about the Bay of Pigs. Some of this stuff is going to start. It's going to start service with colonists that are somewhat respectable. Yeah, Terhorst and people like that.
Good.
We have that little unclear, just to test if you're listening. Yes, we all have heard planted. Okay, this third one is fabulous. I'm sorry to be so excited about something like this. I probably shouldn't be. My job, I should be much calmer than I am, but I'm a passionate kind of guy. No, it's all right. It won't help. Now, there's an issue about the extent to which the president knew about the hush money. And what I'm going to play for you is something that Dr. Cutler incompletely transcribed. For the Watergate exhibit that we did out in Yorba Linda, I decided I wanted us to have the evolution of the cover-up in tape. You can go and listen to it. There are interactive screens. August 1st, 1972 is a very, very important discussion between Haldeman and Nixon. It was not one of those subpoenaed by the special prosecutor. One would have to be slightly obsessive, and by the way, if you're in tapes work, you are slightly obsessive, to have found this. But I don't think there's a better piece of evidence of the president's knowledge of the fact that there was hush money and the fact that there had to be hush money than what you're about to hear. But of course, I'll leave that interpretation up to you. Sometimes I forget I'm an archivist. Come on, baby. This one's so good. I mean, I'd be really unhappy if you heard those two and you didn't hear this one. It's really tired, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was wondering if I just rubbing it would help, but I don't think so. This is also a conversation that involves the idea of pardoning all the burglars. But to do so, because you knew there would be political cost, they were going to round up some Vietnam veterans against the war on trumped-up charges, put them in jail, and then just have a general amnesty for political purposes. It's a fantastic conversation. I mean, that's if you're a bit cynical. If you're not, it's a bit depressing. And all right, baby, here we go. Listen to this. First part's a little bit hard to hear. Gets better.
But everybody's satisfied. They're all out of jail. They've all been taken care of. They're all,
Come on, baby. There you go. They took a hell of a risk, and they just have to be paid. That's yes. So there, you know, if there ever was a doubt that the president understood that there was hush money, there are countless other examples like this. I'm pointing this out to you simply because a lot of this, you won't see references to this in the standard Watergate literature, which should be astounding. But part of the reason is that the books, it was assumed that we knew it all before the release of the abuse of government power tapes. There have been some Watergate books written since 1997. Dr. Cutler, unfortunately, did not really revise his earlier work on Watergate after working so hard to get this stuff released and transcribing much that was important. He didn't use it to revise the basic narrative. Many of the others who have written have not really delved into the tapes. So if you can believe it, this many years after the fact, one could go back to the White House tapes and write a much deeper and much more interesting history of Watergate than we've seen hitherto. And I think once you do that, you find the extent to which the president was involved in the cover-up and the extent to which he was personally responsible for the famous abuse of government power. Thank you very much.